You spend so much time bringing a product to market. You create all this value, and I feel like you're entitled to capture the value. There's very little thought put to pricing. This is why I think pricing should be so important.
Most companies meticulously track every cost, optimize every single process, and strategize for every product launch. Yet, they completely overlook one critical lever when it comes to profit: pricing strategy. Welcome to the Learn It All podcast, the show for today's leaders who want to get ahead and stay ahead of the game, because we know that great leaders aren't born or made. They are constantly in the making. I'm your host, Damon Lemby. I'm the CEO of Learn It, a live learning platform. And joining me today is my buddy and co-host, Darren Bridget, our chief learning architect at Learn It. And I'm beyond thrilled and honored to have Rafi Muhammad joining us today. Rafi doesn't do a lot of podcasts, but let me tell you, he's got over 90 articles published in Harvard Business Review. Rafi's become a thought leader in the field of pricing strategy, sharing his insights on how companies can maximize their profits through strategic pricing. We're going to discuss value-based pricing versus the old method of cost-plus pricing. We'll dive deep into good, better, best pricing strategies, which has been a game changer for Learn It, and the importance of knowing your customer's next best alternative. My first question is for you is, why don't companies pay attention at all to pricing, and what are they missing out on?
No, it's a wonderful question, and it's sort of the opportunity that I sort of latched onto. And I think in great part, it's because pricing has not been accessible to managers. So before I came around, The Art of Pricing came out in 2005. There were a handful of books out there, and the most popular book was a theoretical book that I used when I was a graduate student doing my PhD. So very, you know, it's what you learned on, but this was not managerially relevant. And as the opportunity I found is, since most companies, you know, weren't getting the right education, they were sort of dropping the ball on pricing. And let me give you an example. I gave a talk many years ago to a Fortune 100 company. And at the end of the talk, the CEO stood up. He goes, you know, Rafi, he goes, we've got close to 50,000 people in this company, and we can tell you cost to the penny. And he goes, we don't have one person in this company that's focused on price. This is what I see everywhere I go.
That's a great story. So many companies, like we said, really focus on how do you change your expenses? How do you change all of that? So where do you start with a company when you start engaging with them?
Well, I mean, let me add one thing. And this is why I think pricing should be so important. I always tell people, you spend so much time bringing a product to market. You create all this value. And I feel like you're entitled to capture the value that you create. And that's where most people drop the ball. So, you know, to answer your question, I often start out by saying, well, gee, how are you setting price now? And there are three key ways that prices are set now. Most companies set prices by simply marking up their cost. Okay, very easy to do. Okay, you know, our price is 210% what our cost was. But I often ask people, how many of you go to Best Buy and look at a Samsung 70-inch TV and say to yourself, the most I'm willing to pay is 220% of what I think it costs Samsung to manufacture this television in Korea? None of us. So while marking up costs, cost plus pricing, is very easy to do, it doesn't comport in any way with the reality of how consumers think about pricing. So that's number one. The second way is that literally, it just happens. I've seen this so many times. This is how we've done it time and time again, and this is how we do it now. There's very little thought put to pricing, which is odd. That's the opportunity for companies, you know, any type of company. Is I often ask companies, how confident are you in the prices that you set? And virtually every time I ask this question, the answer is like, not confident.
You just kind of look around and see, what's everybody else doing? Okay, I guess here's where we think we fit in.
It's sort of like a half an hour discussion over lunch, and then you move on.
Right. Well, you found an incredible niche for yourself and just really owning this space around pricing. And I know a lot of it started with something you said when we first got on the podcast, which is value-based pricing. And you've taken that and explain it really well and then built on it. But can you get us started with that foundation of what is value-based pricing? Why is it so important?
Sure. Well, so a great example, the punchline of value-based pricing is very simple. Think like your customer. So a good story that I often tell is that of street vendors in the middle of Central Park. The minute that it looks like it's going to rain, they double the price of the umbrellas. And this very simple story illustrates three key points. First, price for the most part has little to do with your cost. Cost didn't change to that street vendor. Second, price is all about your customer's next best alternative. So I'm in the middle of Central Park. I can run 6 or 7 blocks to CVS, hope it doesn't get rained on and buy it there, or I can have the convenience of buying it now, right there in Central Park. And finally, pricing is about thinking like your customers. So really the notion of value-based pricing is to start off and say, you know, how do I stack up against my customer? What is the customer's next best alternative? Identify that next best alternative. And if you're exactly the same as that next best alternative, which you aren't, okay, but if you were, you have to set the same price. But if you're differentiated from yourself, could be higher or could be lower, then there's the opportunity to play around with price. So if you're better, you have an opportunity to set a premium. But if you're not as good, that's okay too, because you can look a customer straight in the eye and say, look, I get it. We're not as good as the next best alternative, but is it really worth the 40% premium that you're paying? And I always say that if customers wanted the best, we'd all be driving Rolls Royces, not just Damon, but all of us would be driving Rolls Royces.
That's great. No, I love that, Rafi, because what you're saying is you don't need to always either look at being the premium or the lowest guy on the totem pole. Whatever it is your product is perceived as or is, you can build a pricing model to help acquire clients in those areas, and sometimes even both. And when we started working with you, I don't know if it was necessarily your go-to at the time, but you helped us implement something you pioneered, which is known as the good, better, best model. Can you share a little bit about how that works?
Sure. So good, better, best is my greatest hit singular. So it's really interesting. The notion of good, better, best is offering your customers options. We all think that our customers are price sensitive, and some of them are, but not everyone is. So the notion of good, better, best is offering a premium option. And these are people who want your Rolls Royce. They want your best product, and then offering a stripped down version, which I like to have out there to capture price sensitive people who you wouldn't have otherwise gotten in the door. And, you know, offering a well-designed good product is like gaining free money. You wouldn't have gotten those customers in the door. Think about McDonald's dollar menu. Okay. A lot of customers who came for the dollar menu wouldn't have otherwise come. Why not scoop up this opportunity by offering a good version? But here's the thing the two things that make good, better, best so interesting is A, people get it immediately. So when I'm dealing with a client, I talk about good, better, best, I can see it in a second. People are like, yeah, I get it. I understand it. Okay. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is it is so surprising how many people take best, the premium version. So what I say is my rule of thumb is for best is that you can have a package, an option that's sort of call it 50 to 100% higher than your current version. And what we're seeing is a 30%+ market share of people who are choosing best. That's astounding. And I think that one of the things about good, better, best is that clients, they love having the best product. And I think it gives them a lot of pride that, gee, this is really our best. And, you know, it's just been something that has been very successful. And I really think that every company should be doing good, better, best.
I'm with you 100%. What you helped us implement was our partnership packages, which was the bronze, gold, platinum. And I looked at that and we didn't hit the 30% mark, but we're at about 27% of being our platinum, which was huge because it's about 70% more than our better option.
Perfect. I love that.
But one thing you also taught us, and I think this is important for the listeners to think about as well, because a lot of our audience are entrepreneurs and small business owners who are in charge of pricing, is that when you're adding in these features, you also want to make sure that in the better level, that you're not adding too many things in the best that would make your profit margin go down. You know what I mean? So you got to be structured with that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
No, that's a great point. So oftentimes, so there are two things that are important in BEST. A, you want to keep your costs down. So oftentimes there's someone in the room who's like, I think we should have this Dynamis, you know, great thing in there. And I'm like, how much is this going to cost? Because what you want is BEST is your profit. That is where you're, when you sell a BEST, you're like, ding, 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 ding. This was a good sale. So the two things you want to look at in BEST is you want to make sure that the cost level isn't outrageous. And just as importantly, there's a mass appeal. So you don't want to add a feature that, you know, only 10% of people might like. You want it to be, a lot of people say like, gee, this is a great option for me to have.
Rafi, you talked about, I'm trying to understand as I put all this stuff together and, you know, we want to get to like pick a plan and having lots of options. There's so much to unpack here. But you tell this great story about a restaurant that's going to have something like an early bird special, but also going to have like a chef's tasting menu later. It's kind of like how you design the product as opposed to just like, I don't know, throwing more crap in to try to do the better option or the best option. Like, how does that restaurant model fit into good, better, best?
Well, I think the restaurant model is a great example of good, better, best. I often ask people, who is a smarter chef? The chef that's tinkering around with $24.99 or $20.99, or the chef that's offering early bird, regular, and chef's table? And I would argue it's the latter, because offering a good, better, best package is, activates and attracts different segments. So at the high end, you have the high rollers who are out there who want to taste the chef's latest creation, shake the chef's hand, get a picture for Instagram, and they're willing to pay a premium. Then you have your regular customers, and then you can activate customers. It could be a newly married couple who are just celebrating an early anniversary, and they can get a great meal if they're seated by 6:15. And remember, for that restaurant, you know, most of the fixed costs are covered. Okay, you're only talking about variable costs, and you might even say that you get better staff on board because they're working more hours and they're getting the tips from starting a little bit earlier. So it's sort of a win-win. And that early bird chef's table analogy, early bird regular chef's table analogy, is an analogy that every company should be thinking about. How does this work for my company?
It's not just like, here's more stuff, but you're creating a unique experience around each. It's thoughtful and it's designed for that segment, which is cool.
Exactly.
And I agree. I think I totally agree with you on that, Darren. And so, Rafi, as a company starts thinking about it, who should be involved in that conversation?
So here's what I found when you do good, better, best. Usually, as with any type of strategy, there has to be someone who's just strong-willed, who's going to be like, I'm going to make this happen. And the good thing about good, better, best is that, and it's unusual. It's like when you talk about good, better, best, people just get it immediately. You don't have to sell the concept. So that's really good because everyone's on board. But who should be involved are sort of the C-level people who have P&L responsibility, people who are out front working with customers, who have the customer insight. But generally speaking, I think this is really important, is that it's helpful if someone at the C-level is involved, because I've been experiences a couple times where it's just been delegated. C-level is like, oh, we're too busy and this and that. And then what happens is whenever you come back, the C-level will have someone will have a different idea. And so you need someone with some power in there saying, no, 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 we thought about that and we're going to do this. Trust me, I've tried it a few times. I've warned clients. They're like, oh, no, no, it's going to be different. It always ends up where we'll do all this work. We'll come back and they'll be like, no, we got to go back to step one. So I think it's very important for someone in the C-level to be involved with this. And given the upside, it's certainly something that they should be.
I think that's super important because you don't want to spin your wheels with a customer, right? And you're working with the team. You came up with all these great ideas and then you shift it over or you pivot to the C-level to get their feedback. And they're like, nope, we're not going to go forward with this, you know? And then you have to go back to the drawing board. And what I want to say to all of the business leaders out there, who maybe feel like pricing, you know, I don't really want to work on it. I really think that should be one of their main topics or focuses, because whether it's good, better, best, or pick a plan or whatever it is you want to do, it's really not that difficult to implement. I mean, the amount of effort it takes to do and the value it can bring and the impact it could have is tremendous. So I just want to really emphasize that again to all you out there listening, that take some time and really think about it, because I think this is something that could be a game changer for your organization.
Look, I feel that I'm pretty confident saying to companies, you do a workshop or do an engagement, that you're looking to at minimum 15 to 25% upside in profits in the first year. And the reason I could say that is because most companies haven't focused on pricing. So there's a lot of opportunity out there.
You know, what's so cool about it too, is that it makes you take a realistic look at yourself, because you have to tie it to value. Like it's not just like, oh, we entered this market, you know, what other people charge and what's a markup, but it says, what do we actually bring to the table? We need to know that in order to create a pricing strategy. And now you get into strategy. It's all connected.
Absolutely. And so this is really interesting, because, you know, a lot of companies I work with, they cannot clearly articulate what their value is. And so, because I always often say that I want you to brag about your value, and then you're going to set a price to capture it. But you have to let your customers, more importantly, you have to let your employees know what your value is, and then relay it to customers. And most companies cannot clearly articulate their unique value.
And Rafi, why do you think that is?
You know, I don't know. I mean, you know, companies have mission statements and everything, and maybe I'm just too focused on pricing, but it stumps me that a company can't look someone in. I always tell people that you should be able to go to a cocktail party and say, oh, I work for this company, and here's the value that I bring, and you should be proud of it. And I have seen this even for the most mundane products. When people start talking about value, they get very excited. Like I did some work many years ago for a company that made like 2 million plastic chairs. And, you know, the CEO is like, oh, no, we got that covered. We're doing well. And at the end, we had some extra time. So we focused on their value. And we started focusing on like, gee, we're made in America. We have an unlimited guarantee. And at the end, you know, people are like, wow, we actually have a lot of value. And I think they raised their prices by 17% on that just after that simple exercise. So I think it's super important. And, you know, oftentimes you ask companies what their value is, and they just shrug their shoulders. They're like, well, we're better, which, you know, customers here, we're better all the time. I want you to give me the 5 bullet points about why we should be buying from you.
That's why it really makes you take an honest inventory. And you have to be willing to update, you know, because the value that you were presenting in a marketplace 3 years ago might not be the same anymore. And so
absolutely,
you should always be thinking about pricing. You also talk about some, and I think we should, you know, before we move off of good, better, best, because it is your greatest hit, we talk about the Goldilocks option and like, that problem happens when people have too many options. Can you say a little bit about that?
So it's important not to have too many options, because, I mean, there's a famous jam example where when professors taste tested three jams, a lot more people bought in comparison when they did 26 jams. Okay, so you don't want to have too many people, too many options. You know, I often tell people that even I, who's in the pricing business, get confused when I go to a car wash. Okay, but so that's number one. The you know, sort of the curse of having too many options. But the second is that you mentioned the Goldilocks idea, and the concept is simply Goldilocks didn't want her porridge too cold or too hot. She wanted something in the middle, and people are inclined to take in the middle. And so I would agree with that theory. Okay. But if you're doing good, better, best, I think it would be lazy to focus on the middle. I think you should be out there pounding the table. Like, this is our best. This is why you should be buying it. I don't think you should be happy with just accepting the norm of having people come to the middle. And so that would be my thought.
Because you see that, Rafi, a lot, right? Where you go onto these SaaS subscription pages and they have the three blocks and you have the middle that's kind of, you know, 3D pushed out there. But I've heard you say this before, and this is probably in one of our workshops, that a lot of times companies, I think you had a great story around a nonprofit, like you were spinning your wheels with them. And at the end of the day, a lot of people they want to go for the best value. It makes them feel better. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. I mean, you have a good memory. I mean, the story is that I was working with a nonprofit, and even before I gave them a proposal, they were belly aching. They're like, oh, it's going to be too expensive. We're going to do it next year. And I would have bet every dime I had that they would have taken good, because I always offer good, better, best options. And they ended up taking best. And I later asked the manager, I'm like, you know, help me understand what was going on in your mind on this. And she said something, and that really helped me in my thinking good, better, best. She said, you know, we knew we were going to do the project anyway. And we looked at the incremental value between good and better and best. And we thought for our money, the additional money, we got a lot more value going to best. And what's fascinating to me is that it's actually like reframing how people think about price. They weren't focused on the absolute price. They were focused on the incremental. So if I were selling good, better, best, I'd be like, look, for just X amount more, here's what you get. And it reframes how people are thinking about it. It's all about incremental value. Offering these types of plans are about better serving your customers and giving them options. I always say that customers, you know, offering one option and one price is like putting a gun to a customer's head and saying, take it or leave it. And when you have lots of options, they're like, people are more flexible. And it's interesting. I've never figured out psychologically why this happens. But I think if you give customers options, they actually are willing to pay more. Okay. And, you know, I've heard on conference calls, companies that do good, better, best have said this. And I've seen it in practice that, you know, for some reason, when you give this optionality psychologically, people are willing to pay more.
Can you, speaking of paying more, you were talking to, I heard you tell the story of Netflix in 2011 when they sort of forced people to pay more. You would have had advice for them that could have changed it. Can you tell us that story?
Sure. I mean, their stock dropped significantly when they did a price increase. And, you know, I often say that if the CEO at the time, Reed Hastings, had bothered to call me, we could have solved this problem in 15 minutes, and I probably wouldn't have even charged them, you know, maybe some free Netflix or something like that. And what I would have said to customers, like, look, I promise you cheap, low priced streaming, and I'm going to keep that promise. But you have to understand, we're paying a lot of money for this content. We just paid $1 billion for the streaming rights to the CW network. And I'm old enough where I don't even know what the CW network is. We just paid Chris Rock $40 million for two specials. And so our costs are going up. So whatever we have now, you're welcome to have, and that would be our bronze plan. But if you want some of our better content, I'd ask you to consider upgrading to our silver or gold plan.
It sounds like, Rafi, what you're saying right there, which I think is super important, is that when you're working with your customers, think about that as not a us versus them. It's more of we're a partnership, and you're communicating with them, right? You're being transparent. You say, hey, we have to pay Chris Rock for this, or we're adding in this tech that's going to make your life better. So that if you're, as an organization, are you sharing with your customers why you're increasing the prices, that they're more likely to accept it?
Damon, just real quickly, jumping in, because it's a better story, right, Rafi? It's like you're basically saying, thank you for investing in Netflix for all these years, because now we're so successful, we can afford to hire Chris Rock, which means we now have a different option if you would like to join at this option. It's just a much better story.
I agree. And I think what you both are sort of touching upon is this communication with customers. Darren, I know you're really into the communication aspect of a strategy in general. And, you know, I found that most companies, they get nervous when you talk about pricing. They get really nervous because I think the sales force is nervous. I want a sales force to be confident. I want them to go out. I want them to articulate the value. And something I often say is that, you know, in business, it's common for us to say, hey, thank you for buying. We appreciate it. But really, when you think about it, a customer who makes a purchase from you, they're in essence saying, hey, thank you. Actually, I looked around at a couple of different options that I had, and you offered me the best value. And I think every company should be confident that they are offering that value.
I think that's totally true as well. On the flip side, what's your take on discounts? And before we get to discounting, I kind of feel like that the good, better, best, the discount is already like pre-built into it, right? So that's why it's kind of, it's a scale down. So you don't have to have that word discount. But overall, across your strategies, what's your take on discounts?
I mean, there are definitely price-sensitive customers. And I think that it does make sense to offer them discounts. And so I often tell the story about why I think it's sometimes when people offer a discount, I'm like, okay, we're offering 15% to everyone. I'm always about, let's create a hurdle to identify customers who are price sensitive. So good examples. I had a professor at Cornell. He was very, you know, sort of very, very tight. Economists are notoriously thrifty people. And he went to a wine store in Ithaca, New York, and there was a sign above the cash register that said, ask me about a discount. So he's like, you know, inquisitive guy. He's like, what's a discount? And so the guy's like, oh, all you have to do is fill out this form, you get 5 to 10% off. And this professor said, well, why wouldn't everyone do that? And the guy's answer was very prophetic. And he goes, because not everyone cares about price. And I think that's a really important thing. You have, you know, someone who takes the time to clip a coupon, take it to the store, redeem it, they're telling you I'm price sensitive. Someone who takes the time to fill out a rebate form, wait for that Visa card to come, which expires in 6 months, and then spends it in 6 months, they're telling you I'm price sensitive. And I would say that I'm typically price sensitive. And, you know, I remember several years ago, a friend of mine next door, the guy next door office, he was like, oh, he goes, there's a big sale at Barnes & Noble, 25% off coupon in the New York Times. And I was like, great. I later saw him that day. He was just so happy. He had all these books. He was just very pleased. And I remember going to Barnes & Noble a few days later. And when I got to the cash register, I realized I had forgotten my coupon. And, you know, after beating myself a little bit up about for that mistake, it made me realize that I guess I didn't value it as much as the other guy, because if I had, I would have brought the coupon. And that's what you want to do. You want to design a discount system that does its best to really target customers who are price sensitive.
It's an interesting reminder that you got to remember that not everybody's like you. Because for me, when I hear you say that, I want the freedom to not think about price, but I do think about value. Is this a good value? Am I excited about this product? Is it going to last? Do I feel like I'm paying a good price for it? But I mostly don't want to have to think about price. I could just start projecting that onto everybody if I'm the CEO and think, oh, that's how we need to price. Which also brings me to this next question, Rafi, is like, okay, I'm listening to this. I want to start thinking about pricing models in my company. Like, do I start like segmenting all the different customers that we have or the customers? Like, how do I design a good pricing model other than hiring you and your firm? Or maybe that's the only way. I don't know. You can tell us.
I think you start off by reading The Art of Pricing. That book is what, 20 years old? It is still selling a lot, still doing very well. And it's a great intro. Yeah. It's a really great intro. Look, I always thought the second book was better. And The 1% Windfall, which was out by HarperCollins, both are top-notch publishers. But everyone keeps telling me The Art of Pricing is the better book. So I would start off with that.
What's the number one takeaway? Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. That from The Art of Pricing that people have come to you with over the years?
I think the book articulates four key principles. First, we talked about a little bit earlier, is value-based pricing. 90% of companies don't do value-based pricing. So if you do value-based pricing, you're ahead of the competition right there. So value-based pricing is the foundation of pricing. Then I often say that if you want to get fancy, you can get in the strategy of pricing. So Darren, this gets into your question about segmentation, okay? And then if you want to get fancy, you can do good, better, best, which segments customers. You can do pick a plan, which segments customers. And then you can focus on discount strategies for price-sensitive customers. It's really that straightforward. That sort of focus on those four concepts is really everything that a company should really know about pricing strategy.
The other thing to add into that too, right, is it always kind of goes back to when you're thinking about your pricing strategy, and we mentioned this before, is that customers are always looking for the next best alternative.
I love that one. That's such a good way to just remember how to frame up just getting started.
And you know, I feel like your sales force should be so confident that they should be able to say, look, I know you're looking at other people. okay, let me tell you why I'm better, and have that conversation, have that confidence. And here's the thing, most sales forces aren't confident about their pricing. Okay. They're quick to discount, and you know, 1% discount, you know, 10% here or there adds up. 1% discount is a lot of money, takes off your bottom line. Because remember, when you discount, that's coming straight from your profit margin. And most companies' profit margins aren't that healthy. You know, maybe 10, 11%. So if you're discounting 1%, you've just lost 10% of your profits right there. And I don't think most people in sales understand that.
I don't think most business owners really understand that, because they're quick to jump to the discounting. And that kind of takes it to your next book, right? Like, can you share some examples from the 1% windfall of some crazy numbers that just increasing your price 1% can do for your organization?
Sure. I mean, you know, there are a lot of companies where I don't have the numbers right off the top of my head, but 1% can really, you know, often be 25, 30, 50% increase in their operating profits. It's unreal. I mean, I tell this story in The Art of Pricing of Ford, where they did the comptroller of Ford. I remember going to his office, it was a long time ago, and you know, I was sort of new and green. I was really nervous. Go to the top floor, and the guy looks at me, goes, Rafi, he goes, I made it to the top by cutting costs. He goes, one day I did this simple calculation. What would a 1% increase in price do for Ford? And it led to over a 30% increase in profits. And this is a fantastic story. So then this guy, what he did is he had 18 sales regions in the United States. 13 did business as usual. 5 did some very straightforward things on pricing. They did some bundling. You know, they focused on value a little bit. Very straightforward. At the end of that first year, the 13 sales regions that were doing business as usual missed their profit target by $350 million. The 5 pilots beat their profit target by $1 billion. It's unreal. And these were not major changes in prices. So that's why I often say, when people, you know, start talking about, oh, pricing, they get nervous that we're going to do something radical. And my mantra is, small changes in price can have a big impact on your bottom line.
Pricing is like a secret weapon that just more, in fact, it kind of makes me think about what we were talking about when we first jumped on. You just got back from Vietnam. And I mean, this is a passion for you. You're on a mission, really, to change business with this idea that people are just not taking enough advantage of.
I agree. I mean, it's very rewarding. I mean, it's very rewarding to see the ideas that you have really hit. And, you know, Damon and I have talked about, we're both music fans, and you know, I often wonder how musicians feel about that. But when I go into topics like value-based pricing or good, better, best, I just know it's going to be a hit. And the question is, how high is this going to hit?
Speaking of music, didn't you get into the pricing business through ticket sales?
Well, I walked into Cornell with my PhD dissertation in hand, and I was intrigued by bundling that was being done in the music industry. So at many amphitheaters in the United States, much like Shoreline, though Shoreline was not doing it at the time, but they were primarily amphitheaters associated with the Niederlander organization, they would have these things where they would sell bundles up front. So you have to buy 5 or 6 concerts, you buy the bundle, and then whatever tickets were remaining were sold individually. So this is something that's fairly standard. But the fascinating part about this is that the bundle price was greater than the sum of the individual ticket prices. So that was very interesting. So from a theoretical standpoint, it was interesting, but more importantly, I was the first guy, and I think still to the day, the only guy to ever test how profitable this strategy was. Because what was beautiful about this is 1/3 of the amphitheaters in the United States used this strategy. The remaining 2/3 didn't. So basically what I found is, like, you know, if you were a poor act, you know, that you were getting a lot of bump by being bundled with someone who's very popular. And so it's sort of funny. It was really funny because I ended up talking to lots of bands during that time, which is a great experience. And I remember one manager of a band said to me, he's like, you know something? He goes, we had a rough year. And he goes, until I read your letter, I didn't really understand why, you know, at a handful of these places we show up and there were just tons of people. And he goes, these are the places where we were bundled with top acts like Jimmy Buffett or Sting and this and that. And this is what was driving the sales. And what was great for promoters is they were getting some of these lower end acts at a fixed price. So everything associated with a bundle was upside for them.
That's great. That's why you see, I mean, before we went on the air, I was sharing with you that I just was at Shoreline and I went and saw Train and REO Speedwagon. And it's interesting because not only does it bundle and you get more people in, but then it gains fans. Like, for instance, Rafi, I'm an REO Speedwagon fan. I wasn't much of a Train fan, but now that I was there to see Train, who's the headliner, now I'm a big fan of them. So it not only puts butts in the seats, but it also opens your eyes and creates more exposure for these kind of bands.
Absolutely. I mean, the story I have is that I'm from the Midwest, and when I grew up, Jay Giles was great. And Jay Giles was opening for Aerosmith at Fenway Park. And so I went to the show, and literally after the end of Jay Giles, I was ready to leave. I was just going to go home. And a friend was like, you're crazy. Why wouldn't you stay for Aerosmith? I'm like, I don't know. And I stayed for the show, and you know, the show was great, and became a fan and saw Aerosmith a few more times after that.
That's great about the music industry. But I want to put you on the spot here. Is there a particular industry right now that you think that if you could wave a magic wand that you could disrupt by changing the pricing model?
That's a tough question. I mean, in the old days, it certainly was music tickets were completely underpriced.
Not anymore. That's for sure.
That's right.
I think you were talking about like insurance, because the insurance industry is doing kind of cool things, right? Like based
sure.
on mileage
sure.
or records, so, driver records.
Yeah. So you know, the insurance industry. I believe that every insurance product should be offered. You should be offered good, better, best. It's not just coverage. Like, you know, in the Good, Better, Best article, I interviewed the people who designed Allstate's Good, Better, Best, and this is a good story. You know, I remember the guy saying, everyone thought we were crazy because insurance is about the best coverage for the lowest premium. But then they offered good, better, best. They offered some of these attributes like accident-free, you know, for accident forgiveness. And that was really powerful for them. And this is a great story. And then what was interesting, and this goes back to, I think Darren asked earlier about what to put in the best, you know, they were pricing this in, and Best became so profitable for Allstate that the state of California banned it because it was just too profitable, you know? And my question to I remember the guy who was interviewing was like, wow, I'm like, customers had the choice, and out of the freedom of choice, they took Best. And, you know, the guy's just like, look, don't get me started on this, you know? And so, insurance, but I would go back to, and I maintain that every company should do good, better, best. I mean, I hang out with a lot of economists, and economists are just skeptical people. They're just skeptical. And I've asked several economists, I'm like, name one product or industry where good, better, best doesn't apply. And I'll see them racking their brains, and then, you know, they'll just like in disgust say, well, there must be something, but move on. Okay. That's where I really think a lot of the is.
One of the ones that got me was, having done a lot of flying for a while, I always loved it when I would get on a Virgin America flight because they were just better. Plane was nicer. The experience was nicer. Everything was better. But I think really what happened was people just didn't want to pay for it. They wanted that experience, but they didn't want to pay for it. So it's funny that people will take a better option because so often it feels like a lot of industries like airlines, it's like they just kind of crater down because people won't pay the prices, even though they say they want nice stuff. It's hard to figure out what people want, I guess is what I'm saying. That's got to be part of the challenge here.
Well, sure. I mean, generally speaking, when you deal with a sales force or people who are up front, they sort of know. And if you really want to go, if you really want to test some of these strategies, the next step is that you can do basic market research, or you can do conjoint analysis. So, you know, someone in California at Berkeley won a Nobel Prize for conjoint analysis. And this is the notion of trying to doing market research to optimize what's in a package. And so if you really, that's sort of the gold standard of testing the good, better, best.
When it comes to, I mean, we have an uncertain future. Of course, we always do. But I mean, there's just tons of disruption with AI and how things are going. How is that going to affect pricing, or do you see it affecting pricing?
Well, I mean, it's a good question. So a couple years ago, I was looking at flights on, I think it's Expedia or Orbitz, one of the places. And, you know, I was sort of obsessed with this trip. And then when I was in bed, and then I was doing it on my iPhone, and then I went to my laptop, and I was like, wow, this price is very different when I was doing it on my iPhone versus a laptop. And it was even different if I was using their app. Okay. And then Kathy, who was sitting right next to me, did the same search and she found something different. I was like, wow, what is going on? So I was like, oh, you know. And so I wrote a piece for the Harvard Business Review called, it was on personalized pricing. And, you know, we really worked hard to document everything. So there would be, you know, everything was really, really, you know, very well documented. And it did very well. I mean, it got a lot of reading. But what I was sort of surprised about is that it didn't become a bigger story. And so people complain about this, but what's odd is they seem to be accepting, you know, different prices. You know, for someone like Bruce Springsteen to come out and charge $5,000 for a seat, and yeah, he got a little bit of blowback, but, you know, generally it was accepted. You know, is telling me that you and or perhaps I thought that people would be like, oh, this is not right, you shouldn't be doing this. But you know what's odd is that you're not seeing that. And it's something that surprises me. And so AI or data or data-backed pricing that sort of, you know, might personalize a price, I would be nervous about, because people can get wacky about prices. And if they feel like they're being taken advantage of, their attitude of you can turn in a second. But in reality, and I really believe that, but in reality, you're not really seeing that. So maybe there is this flexibility. And look, I get it. Everyone finally gets and understands dynamic pricing for like Uber or this and that. And like, look, it's 12:01. You want to get home on on New Year's Eve. You know, you can hope to get a cat taxi, hope to get a bus, or, you know, for 7X, you can get home with Uber. But it's a different thing is if I'm shopping right next to you online and we're getting different prices. And as of now, you're not seeing a lot of pushback on that.
Do you think it's because of the internet where things are just changing and they're so dynamic all the time where you and so people just, it's just kind of chaotic. So they're just more, they've just become more immune to those kind of differences?
Chaotic might mean sort of like giving up on getting the best price. It could be. You know, I mean, one of the things that I do for fun is, like, you know, when I travel a lot, I use Google Flights to monitor the flights. And I often notice that prices change very drastically. And so if you want, you know, now with the airlines, there's no change fee. So you can call them up or rebook it online. You get a credit for a year. But once again, that's for price sensitive people. How many people are looking at this, monitoring it, and then coming back and say, oh yeah, I want to cancel it and then rebook it? Not a lot of people. So, but I think you're right. I mean, the sort of the chaos, and maybe there's this feeling of, okay, well, this is how it is.
It's like in that 1984 way where, you know, be constant surveillance, right? But instead of anybody caring about that, all they care about is like, how can I surveil you so I know what I can sell you? And the bargain we get is a lot of convenience. So it's like we kind of accept this world where we have a lot of convenience but not a lot of agency to change things. And I think we're just sort of passive in this current state.
Could be, yes.
Rafi, we're coming up on time. And okay. My question to you is, so what's next? Do you have another book in the works?
Well, so there is a new article that's going to come out next year in the Harvard Business Review magazine. Can't really discuss the topic because they don't like it out in advance. But there's definitely a good, better, best book on the horizon, and that'll be a lot of fun. And so, Damon, you would like this story. So, you know, a couple of years ago, I interviewed the guy who does the New Orleans Jazz Festival. And are you familiar with the Jazz Festival?
Of course.
And okay, yeah. Quint Davis was his name. And the vast majority of the admissions are general admission standing, but they do have VIP. So, you know, when I started out the interview, I threw him a softball question. I was like, oh, you know, what has good, bad, best done for your business? And his response was really interesting. He goes, we wouldn't be in business if it weren't for good, better, best, which I thought was really fascinating. So that's something that's definitely on the horizon.
To sum up some of the things that I heard that are my takeaways for today, I really like this idea of creating value and then capturing value. And people can spend, you know, more or less time thinking about that value they want to create, and then spend, you know, maybe a half an hour thinking about how they're going to capture the value. And it's a huge misstep, because these work together synergistically and strategically, sort of in a loop, in a feedback loop. Your pricing needs to be intimately connected to your value, and you need to be able to update this all the time.
And Darren, let me add, and most importantly, constantly articulate it to your customers.
Yes. Yeah, that's great. That's great. And we've got models to do it. And really, they're good, strong frameworks with a lot of depth in terms of the good, better, best, or pick a plan, understanding the Goldilocks spot and the power of 1% and how many people you can actually kind of move into that best category, segmenting the market. There's a lot there. Start with the art of pricing, but we also have the 1%. And of course, there's those 90, I guess now one articles. That people can read.
I think there's 93.
I think there's 96, actually.
Okay, 96.
and here's the beauty. Go to hbr.org. Go to hbr.org, and you can read them for free.
Yeah. Or you can bring Rafi's company out to you, like you do, like you're on the road all the time.
I want to also throw in, though, that a couple of key takeaways for me as well was that pricing is all about the next alternative. I think that's huge. And also that it's important to think like your customer, and that 90% of companies are just doing the cost plus model. So think about the advantage you have there. And the other thing I want to say is, because we talked about all this stuff, but for all you business owners out there, this stuff is not that difficult to do. It's not a heavy lift. So that's what I get so excited about talking about this stuff. So Rafi, if our audience wants to connect with you, you just mentioned HBR, where else can they connect with you?
Oh, pricingforprofit.com. And so you can, you know, there's a lot of information on there. There's a contact page, you know, happy to speak with people who are interested in pricing.
So everybody, you should take advantage of that. I did. I sent Rafi an email. He got back to me the very next day, sent me some links to some of his articles, and then we built up this relationship that I'm super grateful. So for our audience out there, I want you to do me a favor. If either you're an entrepreneur, or let's say you know somebody who's an entrepreneur or a small business owner, or leads a team where they could have impact when it comes to pricing decisions, whatever platform you're on, copy this link and text it to somebody who can gain value out of it. I think that it could be a big game changer. So until next time, stay curious and keep learning. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Rafi. You're awesome.
Thanks, Rafi.
Thanks, Damon. Thanks, Darren.